Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Talks Between Narada and King Prachanabarhi, Text 75. Anena purusho dehan upadate vimunchati harsham shokam bhayam dukam sukam janena vindati anena purusho dehan ena vindati. Anena, by this process, Purusha, the living entity, Dehan, gross bodies, Upadate, achieves, Vimunchati, gives up, Harsham, enjoyment, Shokam, lamentation, Bayam, fear, dukam, unhappiness, sukam, happiness, cha, also, anena, by the gross body, vindati, enjoys. Translation: by virtue of the processes of the subtle body, the living entity develops and gives up gross bodies. This is known as transmigration of the soul. Thus the soul becomes subjected to different types of so-called enjoyment, lamentation, fear, happiness, and unhappiness. Please repeat. By virtue of the processes of the subtle body, the living entity develops and gives up gross bodies. This is known as transmigration of the soul. Thus the soul becomes subjected to different types of so-called enjoyment, lamentation, fear, happiness, and unhappiness. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Jai. According to this explanation, one can clearly understand that originally the living entity was as good as the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his pure spiritual existence. However, when the mind becomes polluted by desires for sense gratification in the material world, the living entity drops into the material conditions, as explained in this verse. Thus he begins his material existence, which means that he transmigrates from one body to another and becomes more and more entangled in material existence. The process of Krishna consciousness, by which one always thinks of Krishna, is the transcendental process by which one can revert to his original spiritual existence. Devotional service means always thinking of Krishna. Man mana bhava mad bhakto mad jati mam namaskuru mam me vaishyasi satyam te prati jane priyosime. Always think of me and become my devotee. Worship me and offer your homage unto me. Thus you will come to me without fail. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. Bhagavad Gita 1865. One should always engage in the Lord's devotional service. As recommended in the Archana Marg, one should worship the deity in the temple and constantly offer obeisances to the spiritual master and the deity. These processes are recommended to one who actually wants to become free from material entanglement. Modern psychologists can study the actions of the mind, thinking, feeling, and willing, but they are unable to go deeper into the matter. This is due to their lack of knowledge and to their not being associated with a liberated acharya. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 4.2, evam parampara praptam imam rajasha yovidhu sakale nehamahata yoganasta parantapa. This supreme science was thus received through the chain of the cyclic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. But in course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science, as it appears, as it is, appears to be lost. Guided by so-called psychologists and philosophers, people in the modern age do not know of the activities of the subtle body, and thus cannot understand what is meant by the transmigration of the soul. In these matters, we have to take the authorized statements of Bhagavad Gita 2.13. Dehinosmim yata dehe komrum yovanam jara tata dehantara praptididastatva namuyate. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body, from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. Unless all human society understands this important verse in Bhagavad Gita, civilization will advance in ignorance, not in knowledge. Translation again. By virtue of the processes of the subtle body, the living entity develops and gives up gross bodies. This is known as transmigration of the soul. Thus the soul becomes subjected to different types of so-called enjoyment, lamentation, fear, happiness, and unhappiness. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Unless all human society understands this important verse in Bhagavad Gita, civilization will advance in ignorance, not in knowledge. Srila Prabhupada, you hear sometimes, or I've heard sometimes, you know, devotees will give class, whatever it may be, Srimad Bhagavatam class, they'll give some talk or some feast program or whatever the occasion may be. And they may speak from Bhagavad Gita 2.13, they may speak from that verse. And sometimes you will hear devotees afterwards, they will make some comment like, oh, not another, not the body class. And when I was reading this morning, it's just such a powerful statement from Prabhupada, the very last sentence of the purport, unless all human society understands this important verse in Bhagavad Gita, civilization will advance in ignorance, not in knowledge. And we're now in the fourth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we can understand the importance of this verse. Probably, at least for me it was, probably the verse that any of us who have learnt verses, probably the verse, the first verse that we all learnt when we first came in contact with the Hare Krishna movement. At least it was for me. Who else was the first time, or that verse was the first verse that they learnt? Well, that's fine, Maharaj, because it's a very important verse, you know. I won't tell anybody else that you only know one sloka from the Bhagavad Gita, I promise. But anyway, it's a very famous verse, but such an important verse. And unless all civilization understands this important verse, then that civilization will advance in ignorance, not in knowledge. So throughout the purport, Prabhupada's talk, of course, the whole section that we're in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is the talks between Narada and King Prachinabharashat and the allegorical story of King Paranjan. And of course Prabhupada explains how we're all Paranjan because we all have a body that we're trying to enjoy, or as in the case of devotees, are trying not to enjoy, but we all have a body, and that's a big complication in our lives, or at least in our eternal spiritual existence, it's a big complication. And here it's very much focusing on the difference between the subtle body and the gross body and the connection between the two. And again, if we go back to that point, the point about the Hinosmimiyatadehe, that you know, we often think of it as such a basic core verse, but something like, we all know that. But actually, when it's described here, the relationship and connection between the gross and subtle bodies, I think it's very easy for devotees, because devotees are, by nature, you know, just the fact that they've taken to Krishna consciousness, are quite subtle as well. And we can quickly understand the incredibly intricate and complex relationship between the gross and subtle body that isn't so easy for us to break free from. In fact, it's impossible for us to break free from on our own strength. It can only be, it was nice listening to the reading this morning from Burujan Prabhu's book about just even focusing on one name of Krishna, just focusing on one name. And it's by that process of devotional service and focusing on Krishna's names and ultimately receiving Krishna's mercy and the devotee's mercy. Another nice point, actually, that I always think of when I'm reading this part of the Srimad Bhagavatam is that Narada Muni, who's probably one of the most qualified preachers in existence, one of the most qualified devotees and qualified preachers. But he's actually very compassionate here, that he's preaching to the king, but he's doing it through an indirect method by relating the whole story of King Paranjan like that. Like, he's not there wagging his finger and getting on the king's case, you know, which in one sense he could do, but he's doing it in a way that is palatable for the king to actually hear, and then by hearing can understand and accept and actually make progress. And of course, as devotees of Krishna and followers of Narada Muni, devotees of Lord Chaitanya, that's really our goal. Our goal is to bring people closer to Krishna. That's the whole purpose of you know, the Sankirtan mission, to bring people closer to Lord Krishna. It's the whole purpose why Srila Prabhupada, at such an advanced age, came to the Western world and underwent, you know, incredible austerities. Why? To give people this message of Krishna. Now, what's the point in giving people this message of Krishna in a way that they're not going to accept it? It's kind of like you're kind of wasting your time. You know? Okay, my mission in life as a follower of Lord Chaitanya, of Srila Prabhupada, Lord Krishna, is to give people this message message of Lord Krishna, of Lord Chaitanya, etc. But I'm going to do it in a way that they're not going to actually appreciate it, accept it, or understand it. It's like, you know, why would we do that? So it's a kind of a wonderful example that we can take from Narada Muni, that's the approach that he took with King Prachana Bharishan. So this connection between the gross and the subtle body, which is a connection that Prabhupada explains actually in an earlier purport. He actually quotes Darwin, and he says Darwin, who was a great philosopher and tried to explain evolution and all these different concepts, but he was doing it exclusively from the platform of the gross material body. He had no understanding of the subtle body, what to speak of the soul. So hence he failed in his attempts in conveying that message, you know, what the actual truth was. I think Prabhupada also mentions around that time that conveying truth, being able to convey the message of truth, the absolute truth to somebody, it's not based on knowledge, or it's not based on being learned, etc., and all these things. What it's actually based on is not being affected in any way, shape, or form, any tiny scintilla of effect being affected by illusion. That if you are in any way affected by illusion, and you know, Maya, that which is not, this is the illusion of the material world, and so many millions of aspects of that illusion. If we are in any way affected by that, then to that degree that we're affected by that, to that same degree, we cannot convey truth, what to speak of absolute truth, because of that being affected by illusion. So Darwin was in that situation, and therefore he couldn't convey the ultimate message. Or the ultimate truth like that. So this connection between gross and subtle body, and how powerful it is, and how strong it is, and how then we can help, it can help for us to understand, because, you know, complacency is like one of these things that, you know, you don't generally really realize, because the nature of complacency. You become complacent, so you're kind of complacent to the fact that you've become complacent. And it's very easy to fall into complacency in everything that we do, literally everything that we can do, and how we run on autopilot. You know, and that was why that reading from that JAPA book this morning, you know, is very much focusing on that, not running on autopilot. You've got to constantly be aware and focused on what you're actually doing. So this can help us. This can help us understanding the connection between the gross and subtle body. Actually, Prabhupada talks about these purports, and you've been going through this section of Bhagavatam, so you're somewhat familiar with them. During sleep, as an example. So during sleep, there's kind of a disconnect between your gross and subtle body. As we all know, we all slept presumably last night. If we didn't sleep, then you should go to Insomniacs Anonymous. I shouldn't joke about that. I know a few devotees who suffer from insomnia, and it's a pretty hellish thing, actually. But anyway, I presume most of us were sleeping last night. So when we're sleeping, we're not actually conscious of the gross body. And particularly, if we were sleeping together, I was nearly going to say we were sleeping together, but if we happen to share a room with somebody like that, I know sometimes when we have festivals here, you may have the European leaders get together, or you have different festivals, that there's pressure on accommodation, so devotees have to, some of us were in Mumbai recently, and there was a lot of devotees there, and there was pressure on accommodation, so you kind of have to share, usually have to share a room with somebody. Now, of course, sharing a room with somebody can be an embarrassing thing, or maybe some of you have experienced it being an embarrassing thing. I certainly have myself in the past, but from my side, not from the other person's side. But that's the subtle body and the gross body disconnecting with each other for the period that we're sleeping. So some people snore when they're sleeping. Some people snore very loudly. Some people snore through walls like that. They do. They seriously, some people, you know. Anyways, but you don't. When you're sleeping, and that actually happened to me one time, I was with a devotee called Gyanadas, and we were in Italy, and we were sharing a room. And he woke me up about 8 times throughout the night to tell me that I was snoring. And I was very patient and very tolerant, but I think on the 8th time, I said, Prabhu, we've got a problem here. You keep telling me that I'm snoring, but as soon as I fall back asleep again, I start snoring again because I can do nothing about it. And then that snoring wakes you up, assuming you've gone asleep, that wakes you up. So then you wake me up to tell me, and then we're both awake. Now, I think that it's probably better off that at least one of us gets a night's sleep. And that, because there's absolutely nothing that I can do about this this thing called snoring. So, obviously, if I'm in tune with my gross body when I'm sleeping, then I wouldn't snore, because actually snoring, it disturbs other people, and you know, if you see people when they're snoring, it can be quite, you know, sometimes they'll start dribbling. And all these kind of embarrassing things that we do, that the body kind of forces on us like that. And as I say, that's in a subtle situation, when we're sleeping. So the subtle body is functioning. One way we know it's functioning is oftentimes people will dream when they're sleeping. And that's another interesting point that's made, that when we dream, we might dream that we're, I don't know, I don't dream very much, at least I don't remember the dreams. I know some people, it's like a movie that they can replay. But sometimes people will tell you they dreamt, probably gives examples about, you know, a golden mountain or whatever, and all these kind of things. So the subtle situation is functioning very, very actively. Is going on very, very actively. And also it's mentioned in this part of the Bhagavatam that anything that we think of, no matter how bizarre, how extreme it may be, we can only think of things that we have experienced. We cannot think of something, and even some of these non-devotee philosophers have that same philosophy, that you cannot think of something that doesn't exist. And of course, that's a very strong argument for an atheist. It's a very strong argument why God does exist, because we don't have the capacity of thinking. Of course, you know, these atheistic philosophers, they don't even accept the subtle body, so therefore you immediately have a problem in trying to connect with them. But the point is that anything that we think of, no matter how weird, bizarre, whatever it was that we're thinking of, we have experienced that in some previous existence. We've actually experienced that, and where that thought process is coming from. So this subtle body, and that's what we understand at the time of death, that you know, the gross body, the subtle body is leaving the gross body. So the gross body's finished. It's actually completely finished. But the subtle body lives on, continues on like that. And then whatever Prabhupada describes that the mind, which is the kind of epicenter, if you like, of the subtle body, it's like a vast storehouse, this vast storehouse of material desire, like a vast storehouse of material desire. So that's the subtle body that carries us into our next situation. Whatever that next situation may be, that's a whole different ball game, and something that is really neither here nor there. But those desires that are carried, those material desires that are carried through the subtle body via the mind, that's what brings us to our next destination. And that's why we're told, here we're told in this purport, manmana bhava mabhakto, and we're also told yam yam bhapi smaram bhavam, that whatever we're thinking of when the subtle body is leaving the gross body, whatever we're actually thinking of at that time, that's where we get carried. That's where we get carried to. And who knows where that is? And, you know, trying to express, and probably not doing it very well, but trying to express this powerful connection that the subtle body has, which is depicted by the mind. And also Bhagavad Gita tells us, udared atmanatmanam natmanam uvashadayat, that the mind can be your best friend, or it can be your worst enemy. So it's your best friend when you're in control of it. When you're in control of the mind, it's your best friend. But when you're not in control of it, when you're not actually in control of your mind, it's your worst enemy. Why? Because the mind is simply the center of the senses, and all it wants to do is engage the senses in sense gratification. And of course we understand that there's no cessation to the level of sense gratification that the senses can engage in. And in fact, the more that they engage in sense gratification, the more dissatisfied they become, and the more that they want to engage in further sense gratification, and probably gives an example of the throwing the petrol on the fire. But the difficulty is that as you engage in more sense gratification, what does it become? It becomes more depraved and debauched and decrepit and obnoxious and outrageous and gross and perverted. And that's what actually happens. Because, you know, if your sense gratification is, you know, drawing a nice picture, but then that doesn't bring you the satisfaction that you want, then you'll go to something, and that's obviously mode of goodness. It's probably even transcendental, because it's probably taking a picture of the deities. But if it doesn't satisfy you, then you go to something grosser and grosser and grosser and grosser, and you get to a point where. And as you do that, the reaction gets heavier and heavier and stronger and more frightening all the time. So we don't know, or we have where we go, we don't know. But it is described that if you haven't acted the way that we're supposed to act according to our relationship with the cosmic manifestation, and of course, ultimately, that relationship with the cosmic manifestation is a relationship with the person behind the cosmic manifestation. That's what we're supposed to be doing, developing that eternal loving relationship. But if we're not doing that, then we have to go somewhere else other than associating with that actual person. So this is the power of the... it's quite amazing, actually. There was one powerful description of somebody who... has been taken charge of by the Yamadutas, are taking charge of them. And so they've left their gross body, they're in their subtle body now, and they're being shepherded by the Yamadutas and some horrendous dogs, the dogs that accompany them like that. And the dogs are biting and snapping at the subtle body of the person involved. And of course, this is incredibly painful. And this is just the entree, because they haven't actually reached the destination that they're going to, but the description is given that the entree alone, with these dogs snapping at the body and biting and biting and biting like that, and the pain is so extraordinary that all that the person wants to do is die. But they can't die because they're already dead. They've already left the gross body, and they have no choice, but they just have to kind of endure this. So these are the kind of places, and that's described in the next canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. These are the kind of places that the subtle body, or the more specifically the mind, can bring us if we're not in control of the mind, if we're not actually in control of it. So that's why we're advised all the time to control the mind. We see all the focus on the mind with all the previous acharyas and beating it and keeping it in control and understanding what it is, you know, and being able to manage it in the proper way like that, is all for our own benefit and our own protection. But we can see from these examples of the power, just of the subtle body, the power of it, that what a challenge that is to us, and we should understand it in that way, that it's a powerful challenge. Actually, recently it was reported that there's quite a big court case taking place in Ireland, because some well-known and successful businessman, Jai Shishirada Gopinath Ki Jai, well-known, successful businessman, was on some, retreat or some business thing away from home, basically, with many members of his company, like that, and they were all staying in some hotel or some facility somewhere, and he actually, he sleepwalks. That's another thing, actually, that again, I don't know. I don't think it's such a common thing that devotees do. I have done it once or twice myself, but it was before I was a devotee. Sleepwalks. We've got sleepwalks. Okay. A little bit of various translations going on there. Basically, it means walking when you're sleeping. So he sleepwalks. And what he did during the night was, and the other problem he has, which you would think that you would take some precaution with this, if you know that you sleepwalk, is that he always sleeps naked with no clothes on. So they were away on this trip, and he gets up and he starts sleepwalking, and he walks out of his hotel room, and he walks down the corridor, and then he knocks on the door of another room in the hotel. He starts knocking on the door. And as luck would have it, he knocked on the door of one of the youngest, most attractive women that was on this business venture, whatever it was. So she answers the door, and then he's sleepwalking, of course. He's totally unaware of what he's doing. And he's then thinking this is his wife. And then he starts engaging in some kind of conversation and whatever, I don't know. But anyway, basically you've got this middle-aged man, you know, standing outside the door of this, you know, young woman naked like this, and then he's treating her as if he's his wife. Anyway, she sued him, and now it's in the courts, and his defense is that I didn't know what I was doing because I was sleepwalking. Which, if true, is true. Now, whether I have no idea whether he's using that as some kind of story. But again, for the purpose of what we're reading here, it kind of indicates how powerful the subtle body actually is and our connection to it. And that's just the subtle body. It's explained here how we can break that connection between the gross body and the subtle body, and it's only through the power of devotional service. And not only is it through the power of devotional service, but in that sense, that alone is not enough. What is needed is the sincerity that we're engaging in our devotional service, the level of sincerity that we're engaging, because it's through that sincerity that Krishna reciprocates and can extract us from whatever dangerous, difficult situation that we're faced with. So it doesn't matter how powerful the subtle mind, the subtle body is in the mind. It doesn't actually matter how powerful they are, as long as we're sincerely engaging in devotional service. And it's through that sincerity that then we are assisted in breaking, because it's impossible for us to do it through our own strength of character, if you like. But we can show that strength of character, and we can show that sincerity by being really determined in what we do in our practice of sadhana bhakti and in the service that we perform. It's no good taking that complacent situation again and thinking that, well, hey, that's okay, you know, it's up to Krishna anyway. There's not much point in me even making a big endeavor, because I know that through my endeavor alone, I'm not going to be able to overcome these things. No, it's actually by making that endeavor, even in the knowledge that we know that it can't be through endeavor alone that we will achieve that, but through that sincere, active engagement in devotional service, Krishna will actually come and be able to lift us out of all these difficult situations when the time comes for him to do that. And we have to recognize Krishna's help also. That's another thing that we have to become sufficiently qualified to recognize Krishna's help. There's one story which is presented as a true story, but you know, you never know with these stories how true they may or may not be. But it's presented as a true story that one devotee, he liked to climb mountains. That was his kind of thing. He liked to climb mountains. Actually, devotees, anyway, some devotees in the UK recently climbed Kilimanjaro Mountain in Tanzania. I think it's in Tanzania, to raise Lakshmi for a particular project in the UK. And they were explaining to me that, you know, this thing, I've never experienced it myself, but when air gets very thin, the effects it actually has on your body and how difficult it becomes, like walking 10 meters that you wouldn't even think about normally, it is actually a massive struggle on the body when the air gets very thin as you get higher and higher. So anyway, this devotee, he was a mountain climber, and he went mountain climbing with some other devotees. And as they were nearing the peak of the mountain, they had to take rest for another night, and the idea was to rise early the next morning, and that next day they would actually reach the peak. That was the kind of the plan. But he was a little proud of his mountain climbing experience, and he also had put in lots of training for it, you know, that he decided that he would get up earlier than anybody. He actually only took rest for 30 minutes, something like that, 30 minutes, and he decided to get up. One of the reasons he did it was because he saw that it was a full moon, full moon day, Pumundi, full moon day. Sorry, it's a private thing in my own mind, you know, I'm not controlling my mind, you know, it's one of these, Pumundi, has anyone ever heard of Pumundi? No? Pumundi used to be in a purple in the Bhagavad Gita. It was there for many, many years. And devotees could never figure out, well, what's Pumundi? They searched, you know, Sanskrit dictionaries, Bengali dictionaries, Hindi dictionaries, you know. They did this, and they could not find what this word meant or what this word was. And then eventually, and they had different devotees listening to the original tape of Srila Prabhupada when he was speaking it, you know, and the Pumundi, Pumundi. And then one day, one devotee had one of what we call a eureka moment, and he says, I've got it. What Prabhupada is saying with his, you know, relatively heavy Bengali accent was full moon day. Full moon day. Yeah. But not full moon day. Yeah. Full moon day. And then that devotee shared that with other devotees, and then all these other devotees listened to the tape again, and everybody had that eureka moment. It was this glorious eureka moment among so many Vaishnavs. Haribo, yes, we found out after 10 years or 20 years or whatever it was like that. So then in the next edition of the Bhagavad Gita, instead of writing on the Pumundi, the devotees wrote on the full moon day. And then there was another eureka moment with some other personalities. Demons, they're changing Prabhupada's words. And you could just imagine if that devotee who had that eureka moment, who was a Prabhupada disciple, you could just imagine if he had that eureka moment and realize that it's not Pumundi, Prabhupada is saying full moon day, and of course Prabhupada was saying full moon day. You could just imagine, but I'm not changing it, because this is what we first, this is the mistake we first made, and we have to stick to our original mistakes. You could imagine that devotee having to go to Prabhupada in person, and Prabhupada asking him, why did you not change it? Well, Prabhupada, you nonsense for not changing it. Anyway, so it was a full moon day. It was actually a full moon night. It was a full moon night, and this devotee thought, oh, great, I'll just take 30 minutes rest, and I'll go and get to the top of this mountain. So he did, and he took all precautions. You know, he tied himself with the rope and all that kind of stuff. I've actually never climbed a mountain, and I don't think I ever will either. Don't have any particular desire for climbing mountains, but I know that they put a rope around their waists and they connect it somewhere. So if they fall, they don't actually, you go. So he did that, and he was making rapid progress up there because it was a clear night, and the moon was shining nicely. And he actually was starting to feel warm, even though in one sense it's a cold thing. So he took his jacket off and he tied it to his backpack in some way or whatever, and he was going for this, and he wanted to get his flag on the top and be there, the first person to be there. But then the weather changed. All of a sudden the weather changed really, really dramatically, and clouds started rolling in really, really quickly, and the moon got covered, and then the wind started blowing and rain started falling, and suddenly the whole situation changed, and he was all on his own. And he couldn't go back. He tried to go forward, but it was very, very difficult. It's like pitch dark, couldn't see anything, and the whole thing. And then he hit what they call rotten rock. Again, I'm not really familiar with the term, but they call it. You're shaking every time I say something. You're shaking your head in agreement. Are you a mountain climber? Okay. But anyway, they call it rotten rock, and rotten rock I think basically means really crumbly rock. So he put his foot on this rock, and he slipped. And then he started falling down a ridge, and the ridge led to a cliff, and he fell over the cliff. Now, fortunately, he was tied. As I said, he was tied, so he didn't actually fall right to the ground, but he was left dangling. He was hurt a little bit because he'd rolled down the ridge, whatever it was. He was not in a great condition, and he was dangling. And then, of course, after 10 minutes or 20 minutes, something like that, he started to really start to feel the cold. Because he had taken his jacket off on the running up the mountain initially when it was okay, so he started to feel very, very cold, and he was just dangling, and he was getting colder and colder, and he was starting to drift in and out of consciousness. But he was a devotee, so he apparently he called on Krishna for help, called out Krishna's name, called on Krishna for help like that. And within moments of calling on Krishna's name for help, he heard. Now, of course, he was drifting in and out of consciousness. So these things are, difficult to verify. But then he heard a voice. He heard a voice telling him to cut the rope, cut the rope. Now, of course, if you're dangling from a rope in the pitch dark, you know, off the top of a mountain, and, you know, it's like kind of like St. Peter and Jesus Christ, when Jesus said, you'll deny me three times before the cock crows. And of course, Peter says, no way, impossible, impossible, impossible. But then, of course, when the pressure's on, it's kind of like, do you know this guy, Jesus? No. Never heard of him. Actually, that reminds me of another thing, that famous story, which I'll probably get wrong, and Maharaj can correct me, because these stories always get altered as time goes by. But that... one time devotees were in court. I think they were just in court because, you know, they were doing book distribution or that kind of thing, and you know, it's technically against the law to be, I think they call it being a, what was it, a vagabond, like, what's it, anyway, what's it called? They call this particular crime, selling on the street, they have a term for it. Anyway, so the devotee ended up in court, and when they went to court, was this the one, or was it, maybe it was a more serious court case actually. Maybe it was a more serious court case. Maybe it was the Susan George court case, actually. Maybe it was. Maybe it was a more serious court case. Anyway, they... Mendicant. Oh, well, in terms of selling, yeah. But I'm just not sure which court case. Was it a minor court case about selling books, or was it a more serious court case that the devotees were being brought to? But anyway, in the court, the prosecutor... wanting to make their case, and of course they do this, they want to make their case, and they make it as powerfully as possible. So in the court, the prosecutor was making their case, and suddenly they produced a big picture of Lord Nrisingadev, Ugra Nrisinga, Ugra Stanhu Nrisinga, the most violent form of Lord Nrisimhadev when he's just pouncing out. Oh, actually it wasn't. It was just after that when he had actually attacked Hiranyakashipu, and he's sitting there and Hiranyakashipu is on his lap and all his entrails are all over the place. That's right. That the classic ISKCON BBT picture. And the prosecutor says to the devotee, with a kind of smirk on his face and a kind of like smug, sarcastic kind of tone, says, "So, Mr. Das, is this your God?" And the devotee, fearing that, you know, if he said yes, that would damage his chances of winning the court case, said, "No, never seen that picture before." So, in difficult circumstances, whether it's St. Peter, you know, whether it's the other situation, or whether it's this situation of the, oh, sorry, what time is it? Maybe I just leave it half time. Okay. Or whether it's this other situation of your hanging from the side of a mountain, hanging, and the only thing that is keeping you there in place is this rope. And a voice apparently is saying to you, "Cut the rope, cut the rope." And you think, "Oh, can I trust that voice?" So this devotee didn't cut the rope. However, daybreak came, and he was then completely unconscious. But the other devotees then, they caught up with him eventually, wherever he was. They saw what the situation was, and they called rescue, and rescue came, and they came, and whatever. When they found the devotee, and when the rescuers came, he was dangling like that from the side of a mountain, but the ground was only 3 feet away. It was just 3 feet away. And as it happened, there was lots of scrub and fire wood and scrub, you know, really dry kind of wood. And of course, he had a lighter with him, being on the mountain. He would have been able to build light a fire and the whole thing. If he had cut the rope, he would just want one. He would have just gone plunk, 3 foot, you know, grab a bit of wood together, light a fire. He could have been, you know, and then he could have probably heated himself up and ran up the mountain and got there first as well. You know, he could have achieved his goal that he originally set out to do. But he didn't have the faith. And then he explains it as the moral of the story, as being a devotee of Krishna, is that we're bound to this material world, we understand, by this rope. This rope is binding us. And it's up to us to cut it. But in order to cut it, it's a leap of faith. We have to have faith to cut that rope, because there are so many things in this material world that for whatever reason, and on that subtle platform again, make us feel comfortable. They make us feel somehow or another secure. They make us feel, you know, even getting out of bed in the morning, you know, the alarm rings. And that's breaking the consciousness, by the way, from the subtle and the gross body, you know, and that's a little bit of a challenge in the morning. But the alarm rings. And what does the gross body, the first thing the gross body immediately thinks of is, it's cold outside. Not getting out. I'm really nice and warm. So the gross body is immediately reacting like that and interacting with the subtle body for the subtle body. No, we'll just go back asleep, you know, and knock off the alarm, whatever it may be. So that's just one simple example, but there's so many examples, our family, our friends, whatever it may be, you know, there's so many crutches that we lean on in the material world. And as it says in the translation here, that thus the soul becomes subjected to different types of so-called enjoyment, lamentation, fear, happiness, and unhappiness. So we identify, the body is identifying that there's happiness here, but we've got to cut that. That's what we've got to do, cut it. And it takes a leap of faith. Etam vibhutam yogam cha. If we accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then hey, Krishna's this incredible personality. Why are we going to have any fear, apprehension, insecurity? Why is that existing if we believe who Krishna actually is? So we have to put that faith into action, cut that rope, and be freed from the gross body, the subtle body, and take shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Hare Krishna. If there's any comments or questions, I'll let you go, Marge, because you have to pack your bags. I'll be ready at 9:30. If there's any comments or questions, please let me know. Hare Krishna. Not been affected by the illusion. Yeah, no, absolutely. 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 Because those comforts that we feel, course, when you're sitting on the Vyasasana and speaking from Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, you have to get the right balance between your own level of realization and speaking, you know, Krishna conscious Siddhanta, you know. So it's not that when the alarm rings for me in the morning that my sleeping bag doesn't feel like a place of comfort, you know, it does, but that's when you get into, you know, Thakur's example of you've got to beat the mind, you know, it's like, you know, wise up, wise up. One of the things that can greatly help, it's such a short-term thing, you know, thinking that's in some way comfortable for different reasons. You know, one thing is, if you go to India, some of us have just come back from India, and it's like the last thing you want in India is a sleeping bag. A sleeping bag is like a source of suffering. You know, it's like, you know, you arrive in Mumbai. I arrived in Mumbai at midnight, literally midnight. You arrive in Mumbai and say, so the first thing when you land, they say, welcome to Mumbai, where the outside temperature is 34 degrees. It's like midnight, and it's 34 degrees, you know. So the last thing you need in India is a sleeping bag. So it's all circumstantial, Matraspa Shastu Kantaya, the very next verse after Tahino Smim. It's all very, very circumstantial. And then the other thing is, you're going to get up at some point anyway. So better that you get up nice and early so you can get your day off to a good start, rather than succumbing to the mind, which is the subtle body and then the gross body, and allowing yourself to stay in, and then, you know, getting up at 6 o'clock and not getting any rounds done or whatever it may be. So it's part of the illusion, because they're illusions, you know. Taking shelter in your sleeping bag, you know, it's not going to protect you from death, you know. It's not even going to protect you, like, you know, from feeling really hungry in a few hours' time, where you're just going to, you know, have to get out of the sleeping bag anyway, for a different type of sense gratification. So yeah, they're illusions. They're just illusions, and we have to train our mind, you know, to understand them for what they are. And as we train our mind, and it really is like that. It really is like that. The more you train for something, the easier it becomes. And anybody who has ever done any athletics or any sports or anything like that will know that. I used to play football when I was younger. When the season was finished, you have a break of 3 months or 4 months, you know, and then the first day back training was like torture, you know, and the next day when you would wake up, you couldn't move. Every muscle was just like frozen, stiff, you know, and whatever. It was like torture. But after 2-3 weeks, you just don't feel it anymore. It's gone like that. So it's just training the mind. You know, what's nectar in the beginning is poison in the end, and what's poison in the beginning is nectar in the end. And you know, we get direct experience of that very, very quickly. It's not really that long. It doesn't take that long for certain things that we were actually very attached to, or certain things that seem to mean a big deal to us. It doesn't take us that long to actually come to the platform where we don't miss those things anymore. Eating meat, as an example, is an obvious example for devotees. Millions of people, billions of people on this planet that are going to have their breakfast in a few minutes, just like us, are going to sit down to something like bacon and eggs, or maybe worse. They don't know. They're in ignorance. This is this point about them being in ignorance and us as devotees meant to have compassion for them. They don't know that by eating what they're eating is going to cause them unlimited suffering for billions of lifetimes, simply because they're eating this particular substance. But we know as devotees, do we miss eating meat? It's like horrible. The thought of, if you walk past the butcher shop and the smell of it, it's absolutely disgusting. You know, it's horrible. But there was a time when most of us, at least, maybe some of us not, but when most of us did every single day. 3 times a day. We sat down and we were eating meat and probably liked the taste of it, certainly thought there was nothing wrong with it, and probably enjoyed it. But now, it would be the most obnoxious kind of concept to actually sit down and eat some meat. So actually, you train the mind. And as you train it, these things don't become an issue for you anymore. Now, unfortunately, other things become issues. Until you do get, and you go through the whole process of, you know, the 9 different stages, and you cleanse the heart completely. So there are other things that replace those things, but you can be full in knowledge that you're making progress. You're making progress, and Prabhupada says very clearly, you know, Satchit Maharaj asked him in the very early days. He asked him 2 questions at different times. One was, do we reach a platform from which we do not fall? And Prabhupada said yes. And another question he asked him at a different time was. Probably it seems we get so many tests in spiritual life. is there a will we always get these tests? And Prabhupada gave him two answers. He says, one, Krishna never gives you a test that you cannot overcome or you cannot deal with. He never gives you something you can't deal with. And two, yes, there are different levels of tests, and there comes a point where you overcome a test that shows a certain level of sincerity, and from that point on there are no more tests of that nature like that. So yes, we go through this stage, there are tests, we have to deal with them, but we're making progress. Meat is not an issue. For 99.9% of people who chant Hare Krishna, meat is no longer an issue, never will be again. It's gone, it's over. That's a test we'll never have to face again. We've passed that. You know, also for most devotees, intoxication, no longer an issue, gone, finished, like that. Gambling, gone, finished, you know. So maybe most of us are still having to deal with sex life like that, but just as in the other three, there will come a time, there will come a point where it will no longer be an issue like that. It's just to train the mind. And what's the alternative? If you don't train the mind and you don't make it your friend, it becomes your enemy. And then you just fall to God knows where and all the unlimited sufferings that come with it. Okay, I better finish actually because I won't make it for 9:30. Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Sri Damodarastaka ki.